This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on this show, we have so many great segments for lovers of words. We have an essay on ballads, and we have a feature about cowboy poetry. But we are going to start with aphorisms. The best wisdom comes in the fewest words. The flame that burns twice as bright lasts half as long. There is truth in wine and children. Measure twice, cut once. The art of the aphorism, a concise, memorable expression of a general truth, is on display in the book Reality Can Be Okay, But Mostly It Bites. R. Bill Thomas speaks with author Gordon Hutchison about his collection of 400 original aphorisms.
Well, Gordon, thanks for being with us today. And your book has bites in the title, and it's aphorisms, original aphorisms, and other philosophical fragments with teeth. And I think people have a general idea what an aphorism is, but maybe if you could just give us an example right off the top here.
When I started to put out this book, I really didn't have a clear definition, and I don't think that many people do. And one reason is because there's so many different types of sayings that are close, like proverbs and adages and maxims and all that. But what I discovered in terms of an actual definition was one dictionary defined it as concise observations that contain a general truth, and another one as pithy observations that contain a general truth. So the general truth is kind of common to both. And then there is a man named James Geary, whose introduction I read when I was researching my own introduction, and he gives five criteria. It must be definitive, must be personal, must have a twist, must be brief, and must be philosophical. Now, I'm not sure what philosophical means other than perhaps containing a general truth, but that's what he says, and that's a start.
Well, give us an example of one of your own aphorisms.
Okay, then. Let's see. One of my own is, nothing takes the fun out of a great idea like putting it into practice. And this is, I'm not sure, a general truth, but it's certainly my truth.
That one seems right in the middle of kind of a range of feelings or tone of aphorisms, because some of them, they're amusing but cynical.
Irreverent,
They have, no man is so creative as when making excuses, is one from your book.
Absolutely. That is why people who were looking for advice, inspirational quotes on marriage should probably not, you know, they won't love this book, nor will devout Christians. If you want to get into some of those, here another one is, beauty is as beauty does, and it's not always pretty.
But now some of yours are gentler. They like, here's one: all the great wisdom has been said before, but much of it bears repeating.
Yes,
which doesn't have quite the bite. You mentioned teeth and bites a bit in your titling of your book.
Yeah, I didn't carry the parallel that far. That just happens to be. But my inspiration for these things came when I was 20 years old in psych class, and the class read a book, Life Against Death by Norman O'Brown. It was a big academic property back in the day. And Brown rethought and reworked Freud's body of work, and he took out many of the sexual biases, the gender biases. His thesis is that man is not really in control of his own behavior. He's not in charge. And a lot of these things are reflections of that. I started writing these in about 1995, and it was just like a diary, me reacting to life. And I was in Japan at the time, and I was, you know, 1995, I was, God knows, 30, 35, 45, yeah. So I was more irreverent then. And the social conflicts in Japan are not as visible and on the surface as they are in America. And then when I got to America in 2005, I started reacting to the environment I found myself in, and that's when a lot of the more actual, quote, philosophical ones, you know, and there's, let's see, the tragedy of poverty is there comes a point after which you no longer live in it, but it lives in you. Now that is, you know, that's my reaction to the class and the economic inequalities, the race differentials that are in America. So a lot of my one-liners are not aphorisms. In fact, the majority of them, they do not meet the criteria that the five criteria that I gave you at the outset, and a lot of them are questions.
And some of them are very amusing, too. And that twist that
right.
you have in the aphorism, that as you write them and as you say the characteristics at the beginning, mm-hmm. is similar to the twist in a joke. But these are not just they're not just one-liner jokes. They as to be an aphorism, they need to have a little more than that, I think.
Laughing to keep from crying. Or I am deeply disappointed at, you know, how the human race has turned out. and so a lot of the one-liners in there are actually in the form of questions, and I'll step back and give you some background. Okay, so
sure.
After I got back in 2010, say, I had several hundred of these things, and I was thinking about putting it out just as a gift book, but even, you know, I wanted to do a good job on it. So that's when I started reading other compilations of other people's aphorisms, and so I could get an idea of how they introduced the book, okay? And I love a good aphorism, especially a snarky, irreverent aphorism. Oscar Wilde, Dorothy Parker, people like that. And I was, as I was going through all these books, and I must have read 50 of them, I noticed that many, many times, in fact, in the book you'll see below about half of them, there are other people's quotes.
That are related to the aphorism that is said?
Well, basically they say the same thing that mine says, only I didn't know that when I wrote them.
Uh-huh. I thought that was very, very generous of you to put those in like that.
It wasn't generous. That was what convinced me to write the book, finding that I was thinking the same things that you know, historical figures, famous and notorious, some of them, have observed for centuries. And so I felt validated in one sense, and yet I felt deeply disappointed in another sense because the human race hasn't made any progress. They're still the same idiots they were back in the old days.
And
yeah.
I note one here. Here's one you have. Here's your aphorism. It's impossible mm-hmm. to reason with believers, small children, and empty stomachs. And then below that, you have from Jean de La Fontaine, who's a 17th century French writer, a hungry uh-huh. stomach has no ears. And then you also have from a 19th century to the 20th century Latin writer Santiago Ramon y Cajal, that which mm-hmm. enters the mind through reason can be corrected. That which is admitted through faith hardly ever. So echoes,
yeah.
There are echoes down through time of these aphorisms that you've come up with.
And that is what, you know, that gave me the validation, and it produced, you know, I thought that was kind of special enough to differentiate it from a lot of other books, and that's what convinced me to actually to put the book out. In fact, one of my favorites is, "He who lives for the hunt rarely savors the kill." And I found 16 other people throughout time, the past couple thousand years, who said the exact same thing. Now, I only have room to put in, I limited myself to two per one-liner. But that made an impact on me. So that basically is why that was the tipping point at which I decided to actually put it out, if only for my friends. And I discovered a lot about myself because I felt a great sense of continuity with this people. And like I said, I felt validated and disappointed at the same time. And I realized, and especially in a lot of the questions, that I was reaching out to people to see, well, do you guys get the same sense that I do, like this world is totally crazy and screwed up? And I discovered that. Up until then, especially the snarky ones in Japan, "Life is too short to play fair," "Dirty minds think more," stuff like that. T-shirt captains, basically. Well, actually, I plan to, you know, to maybe make some T-shirts. But that was the evolution of it all. And it was fascinating. And I discovered that about myself, that I wasn't just being snarky. I was describing my own state of mind. I don't know whether you know that much about Japan, but everybody drinks over there. And I was one of them. And that's where a few of them came from. There are no speed limits on the road to ruin is one.
Well, and there, I see you have in here, "The less you remember, the more fun you must have had."
Which exactly. Is that was another
clear one.
If you can still say, no, you haven't had enough, or something like that.
Yeah. Now, you know, you mentioned Japan a few times, and you lived in Japan for a while. Do you think that shaped your affinity for aphorisms?
No. I have loved wordplay since I can remember. And what happened in Japan was I was lucky enough to become an advertising copywriter. I have had this isn't braggadocio, but I've had a very diverse life. I was in a Zen temple for 3 years, studied cultural anthropology at Sophia Grad School, and then I got a job at the world's largest advertising agency at that time, a place called Dentsu, and I was the only copywriter who could speak and read Japanese, so I was, you know, I got a different category of work. But that's where I started learning what advertising copy was. And so I realized that instead of just feeling something, I was kind of, you know, compulsively putting it into a form, a coherent form in words, because somehow I had more control of the situation if I could put it in that kind of form, and especially one that brought out the irony, and there's the humor also.
So the advertising copy and the aphorisms have related protocols, kind of.
Oh, yes. It's wordplay. And, you know, advertising copy is, it's wordplay, it's word manipulation to convince people to buy stuff or to convince people to do stuff that you want them to do. And basically, that's what we're all doing, even in everyday conversation, but that was a natural inclination of mine. I just love wordplay. I write songs. I've written all kinds of stuff. I can't do a whole lot of other things. I don't have a whole lot of other skills, but I've always played with words, and so this was just one more kind of genre of that for me.
And the aphorism seems something. it seems to me anyway that it's so suited to conversation. It's a great, you know, to insert into a conversation and the poets in the tea houses of Japan or the philosophes in the salons of Paris, you know, coming out with these aphorisms. So let me ask you about the trick of putting them in a book. You said there's a lot of books of aphorisms, but it seems like a funny place for them in a way.
Well, a lot of these people, I mentioned Oscar Wilde a little while ago. He wasn't an aphorist who just wrote one-liners. He was a playwright. Likewise with Dorothy Parker. She just gave out with these snarky comments, and actually they had a little coterie back in the day where they'd get together and trade them off or make new ones. There's one guy named Ashley Brilliant, who writes what he calls epigrams, and he limits them to 17 words. I don't know why. Maybe it's from 17 syllables in haiku poems in Japanese. But there's nobody else that writes original aphorisms, at least not in books, because they just don't sell. And luckily I'm old and retired, and this, you know, I'm not trying to launch a career as an author. You know, if the book doesn't do well, I'm not going to lose the farm.
So one of your aphorisms is, people unable to overcome their own insecurities often make careers capitalizing on the insecurities of others. But that's not the case with this effort, huh?
Oh, no. No, 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 no. This is just, I have been blessed by a freedom that gives me the opportunity to dip into various creative endeavors and not get sucked into the industry and the ugly side of it. You know, like when I was looking for a literary agent for my first book, which was a memoir of three very strange years in Japan, it just kept occurring to me, I would read these self-promotion books, and they say, well, you have to do this and that, and looking for a literary agent. And I found myself thinking so many times, good Lord, I'm so glad I don't have to do this for a living. And it's just like trying to be a rock star, trying to be a movie star, trying to be a writer. It's a dog-eat-dog, cutthroat world out there. And I can do what I want. I feel very fortunate. At the same time, having been a copywriter, I was able to, you know, I learned Japanese by myself, so I made my living at something I loved, and I learned by the sweat of my own brow. And it was very lucrative, too,
right?
Back in the 80s when Japan was buying up half the world. So I consider myself extremely fortunate compared to people who come out of college with mountains of student debt and have to go into a job that will help them repay that, over going into a job that they love and can give their lives to.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us and sharing some of these aphorisms and your approach to life with us. I've been talking with Gordon Hutchison, the author of Reality Can Be Okay, But Mostly It Bites, and it is a book published by White River Press. Thanks so much.
Can I say one more thing?
Go ahead.
The one thing that I would, you know, if I had to make a pitch for this book, is that it's perfect for the bathroom, in the sense that you can go into it anywhere, spend as much time as you want. It doesn't require a great time investment. You can do it whenever you want. Open up a page, and there you go.
All right. Thanks for being on the radio with us.
Absolutely. You take care then, Bill.
And Hutchison was speaking with our director of radio, Bill Thomas. Coming up next, from pithy advice to narrative song, it's a Tom Ezern essay.
Early automobile trails in America included the 1914 Red Trail that extended from Seattle to New York City. The Red Trail became Highway 10 in 1927. And today, you can still drive a section of that original route in the Old Red Old 10 Scenic Byway between Mandan and Dickinson. You can enjoy a pastoral country drive and the small town amenities in New Salem, Almont, Glen Ullin, Hebron, and Richardton. More information about the Old Red Trail can be found online at oldredold10.com or on their Facebook page.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. North Dakota has a long tradition of independent politics. Tom Ezern waxes nostalgic in this week's Plains Folk essay, The Balladeers of the Nonpartisan League.
We'll stand by you, Lynn Frazier. We'll stake our all on you. Son of our glorious Sunshine State, we know you're loyal and true. Our North Dakota, Washington, yours are the hand and pen that struck the gives from off our writs and made us free again. Historians of the Nonpartisan League, our great farm movement of the early 20th century, have known all along that the Leaguers were a singing lot. Like the Grange and the Farmers' Alliance before them, the NPL raised a crop of balladeers who assailed Big Biz and the old party bosses while extolling the virtues of farming and farmers. Norwegian farmers were at the heart of the Nonpartisan League, I think because they were prepared for it by old country experience. Although many here denounce the NPL program as socialist, to people like Hans Olufsen Svee, from whose ballad I just quoted, NPL doctrine sounded a lot like that of Hans Nielsen Hauge, the Norwegian evangelical minister who preached salvation through self-help and community cooperation. It may be a stretch to call Lynn Frazier our North Dakota Washington, but my reading of Terry Shoptaw's book on leaders of the Nonpartisan League convinces me that Frazier was the best of them and deserving of a heroic ballad. The song emanated from Max Bass, North Dakota, where H.O. Svee labored on the farm established by his immigrant father. Young Svee was born in Midtry Gauldal commune, but as a naturalized American citizen, he took part enthusiastically in the politics of his adopted land. He served in the Coast Guard during the Great War, and he reckoned Governor Lynn Frazier the hero of his times. We're proud of you, Lynn Frazier. You're not afraid to fight, for you buckled on your armor in the cause of God and right. Other historians of folk song and the NPL have not focused on the movement's balladeers, but the time is right for the wonders of digitization and optical character recognition make it possible to track down the previously obscure poets of the NPL. Like another young Norwegian farmer, Louis P. Larson from Litchville, or rather just over the line in Lamoure County, where Larson also worked on his immigrant father's farm. I read in the Leader that somebody said they were going to put Townley in jail. When Larson learned that his hero, NPL organizer Arthur C. Townley, had been arrested for sedition, he burst into song. Now, Larson frequently resorted to verse. One reason, he was a well-known man about Litchville. The press noted his comings and goings, as when he traveled to Fargo to take the course in steam traction engineering from Professor Rose. The arrest of Townley moved Larson to mock distress in the Ballad of Townley's Crime. Oh, gee, I was scared, and the tears that I shed, how I shivered and muttered and swore. Larson predicted a good end for the matter, that the jury might convict, but the judge would send Townley home. You're sentenced, he said, to ride home in a Ford, because the NPL was known for its pioneering political strategy of organizing the countryside by automobile. History records that Townley, however, was not so fortunate.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Coming up on Main Street, more lyrical stylings, this time as poetry. And summer events come back after pandemic pauses. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Minot Police Department is closing the 2006 missing person case of 3-year-old Rachel Smith. Smith was last seen by her aunt and legal guardian on May 16, 2006. At that time, the aunt's roommate, Lee Cowan, claimed his mother had taken the girl and would be keeping her for a few days. Captain Jason Sunbakken was one of the primary investigators on the case.
We determined later that Rochelle had never been with Lee Cowan's mother. The fact that we found her blood evidence in the cooler, which hadn't been used by the family in some time, and just his behavior over the period of the 5 days before he killed himself, we determined that there is no other explanation other than the fact that Lee Cowan likely killed Rochelle on the early morning hours of May 17, 2006.
When the aunt's car was found, Lee Cowan's body was discovered inside. Authorities believe Cowan died from carbon monoxide poisoning. Assistance checks have begun to flow to Minnesota landlords with renters who are behind in their payments. The money comes from a $672 million federal housing aid fund. It's meant to help people who are late in their rent or utility payments, or who may soon be behind in those payments. Minnesota Housing Commissioner Jennifer Ho says as the rollout picks up, lawmakers should proceed carefully on an on-ramp to an eviction moratorium.
The anxiety of both owners and renters is real. Getting people paid is a win-win. Why would the legislature want to inflict unnecessary harm that creates a chaotic environment when we are all tired for what we've been through with the pandemic and the economy?
Minnesota Governor Tim Walz does not intend to rescind the moratorium until lawmakers reach an acceptable agreement. And who would have thought we might be talking about potential frost in late May? It is a possibility. Bismarck National Weather Service meteorologist Alex Edwards says a low-pressure system is bringing very windy conditions to much of North Dakota today. He says behind it, unseasonably cold temperatures as a Canadian air mass comes down.
We're looking at about three nights or early mornings of possibly near-freezing temperatures across much of western and central North Dakota. At least lows down into the 30s for sure. And that will be each night through Friday morning, and then we're expecting it to warm back up after that. Those with plants, concerns, there's certainly some frost or freeze potential with this.
Edwards says there is a possibility of showers and thunderstorms across southern North Dakota. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Last year, the COVID-19 pandemic forced many small towns to cancel large festivals that they depend on for tourism. As small communities are holding these festivals again, Harvest Public Media's Katie Pikus reports what this means for small towns.
People wearing traditional Dutch clothing are throwing buckets of water onto the street. It's part of the Orange City Tulip Festival, celebrating the small northwest Iowa town's Dutch heritage.
That's right. Give them a round of applause.
Locals scrub the street to pave the way for this year's elected Tulip Queen and her court.
Feels refreshing to be back doing something that we love.
Brandy Pals watches the parade with two of her friends. They're all locals who volunteer at the 3-day celebration. This is the Tulip Festival's 80th year. The town had planned to mark that milestone last year, but it got canceled that spring. And that was a blow to the town. Orange City's population is 6,100, but the festival draws in at least 80,000 people from around the world. Mike Hoffman with the local Chamber of Commerce says it's a big gain for the town, but it's hard to say how big.
You can't put a finger on the fact that people come back and experience the small businesses throughout the course of the year, not just during the festival.
A little while after the parade, people sit in the Dutch bakery enjoying pastries.
And then one Dutch leather.
Small businesses like this make a lot of their yearly income from the festival. The bakery's owner, Lauren Mulder, says the money his business makes over these 3 days equals about 2 to 3 months of normal income.
It probably makes or breaks our year. Without it, yeah, it would be more difficult for us to survive, basically.
Mulder says last year was tough. After the pandemic forced restaurants and other retail to close, he had to lay off some employees. Dutch Bakery did curbside pickup to stay afloat. While pastries are definitely a draw, most people come for the tulips. More than 30,000 bulbs are planted around Orange City in the fall. By festival time, the bright colored flowers are in full bloom. Carrie Drescher points out a couple of her favorites in her yard, a pink tulip with some yellow and an orange tulip.
The Blushing Beauty and the El Nino, they're just a big, giant tulip. They always bloom beautifully.
Carrie co-owns Tulip Town Bulb Company with her husband, Dan. They import bulbs from the Netherlands and plant about 3,000 for the festival. People visit the Dreschers to pre-order bulbs for their own yards and gardens. They say tulips are pretty easy to care for.
People that can't garden, you can grow tulips.
You can plant them completely incorrectly and upside down, and
they'll
turn themselves over and push themselves through, and they're pretty resilient.
Stain Muckow and his family admire the tulips. They moved from Portugal to the U.S. last year and drove an RV 6 hours from Minnesota to Orange City.
We wanted to get out, and she wanted to come and see this down here, and now that we have the RV, we're camping every weekend and going out.
Orange City isn't the only town that holds a big Dutch festival. About 4 hours away in central Iowa, Pella's Tulip Time is a huge economic booster. Valerie Van Coten is with Pella Historical Society and Museums.
Tulip Time brings in $2 to $3 million to a 30-mile radius of Pella, to the restaurants and the hotels.
Van Coten says Tulip Time saw around 160,000 people this year, fewer than a normal year, but more than expected. She says last year's canceled festival had a silver lining.
A lot of people realized, oh, wow, if Tulip Time were to go away, it would really hurt this community.
And that's something a lot of towns have realized. Their businesses, and sometimes much of their economy, depend on these big festivals. Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaborative effort to report on America's ag and rural issues. I personally would love to see a field of tulips, but frankly, I'm just happy to see any events bouncing back after 2020. And Memorial Day is, of course, the unofficial start to summer. Last year's annual cowboy poetry gathering had a little bit lower than average turnout. How might that compare with this year? We visit with founder Bill Lohman. Bill, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Ashley.
I'm wondering how this year's event will compare with last year's. A lot of events had to get canceled last year. You were able to do this. Were there some differences last year compared with how you're able to do it this year?
This year we're getting a lot of interest and a lot of response. This year it should be back to normal. Last year we did go through with our gathering, but the attendance, public attendance, was down, which we expected. The performers were all there and loved to doing it, but we expect a good year this year.
How much of a draw is this? How many people are you expecting?
This is our 35th annual, and we have about 30 singers and poets each year. It's really consistent. We draw several hundred. Our day sessions, both Saturday and Sunday on Memorial Day weekend, the 29th and 30th, are open to the public, to no charge, free walk in, walk out as you please. And then at 1 o'clock both days, Saturday and Sunday. Then on our two night shows, Saturday and Sunday night, two different shows completely. We have professional shows at 7:30, and we charge for that. We get a pretty steady family of several hundred people. It seats about 400 in there, and we're pretty tight both nights, so it's pretty steady.
How do you construct a cowboy poem? Because this is not just any poem written by a cowboy. It is an art form unto itself.
That's a very, very good question. I appreciate that. My poems and other people, and even, you can you read about Hank Williams Sr. or Frank Sinatra, and their songs, their best songs, came to them so fast they hardly had time to get them down. And I experienced that same thing. I never force a poem. I let it write itself. I carry a notebook and write notes off my saddle horn on my horse or my haying tractor or steering wheel, or wake up at 2 in the morning and jot down notes. Those things write themselves. The ones, and they turn out by far the best, the ones that you labor over and try to make them perfect just never seem to work as good. So, yeah, that's a good question, but it's just a natural thing, and I never force a poem. We all of us poets have a box full of half-written poems that the idea was there and stuff, but it didn't complete itself. So you don't force it. You let it, and someday maybe it'll come back to you and finish itself.
So the common themes of a cowboy poem, this grew out of that great oral tradition of telling stories on these long, hard nights after those long days. What are some of the themes that tend to show up most often? I'm thinking horses, well, sunsets.
Yeah, that's a you're asking some very good questions. I've been with the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering in Elko, Nevada as a charter member in 1985 since it started. And the first thing that really surprised me when I went out there, we have different subcultures within our culture of cowboys. All through the way, there's the northern family-owned ranches that we run our total business from A to Z, make all of our business decisions and stuff. And then you run into the outback buckaroos that work for big corporations that are owned somewhere else in the cities, and they're day work cowboys. And the poems, it really surprised me right off the start. Us, we're managing time when we manage our own ranches and our own business. We're managing time, and when we write a poem about something of our life, we get in and make our point and get out in a matter of 6 or 8 stanzas. Paragraphs, and then the buckaroos would go on for 10 minutes with a poem, and you'd think, well, boy, they're about done. It's a good poem, but they're about done. They'd go on for another 5 minutes, and I related that to that they're day work cowboys working for a big corporation and have no interest in the business of it, and time isn't as valuable to them. It's just another day of cowboying where we are managing time because we're managing our own business. And that was really interesting to me, and that question relates to that you asked, that the subcultures within our culture, we're managing time.
Do you, Bill Lohman, think that you could read a poem, author unknown, and get a good sense of what type of work this poet does on a ranch, or where this poet might be from?
I suppose I could. I'd never thought of that. I'm a contemporary poet. I like the old. See, the cowboy poetry really flourished in the late 1880s, 1880s, 90s, in the big long Texas trail drives up into our country up north here for self entertainment, to entertain a girl when they got to town, but then it died out. So I like those old poems, but I'm personally a contemporary poet. I write about what happens in my own life and my own experiences. I'm dyslexic, and I struggled with school and with literature, but I'm an authority on my life and my happenings, and even if my poem is a little bit not metered right, or my literature isn't right, my English isn't right in it, I'm still the authority of it. No college professor can say that's wrong because they weren't there. I was. And I'm total authority of it, and I have total confidence in what I write because of that. So, yeah, I don't know if that answered your question or not, but I'm a contemporary poet. And I don't judge other people's poems because I don't want mine judged. You can't judge mine. And I'm also not in favor of some of the poetry gatherings around the country have started a competition, and the national gathering and my gathering in Medora, I'm proud to say it's not a competition. It's a sharing of a tradition. and there's no way you can judge it because everybody's different and everybody's talking about their lifestyle and what they've done, and nobody else was there to judge it. So that's where I come from on that. I'm a contemporary poet, and I refuse to be judged or judge other people's poems.
Where do you see the future of the art of cowboy poetry going?
You are really good with questions. I've sat on a board or two and a committee or two in the National Gathering at Elko, and the first thing that came to mind with them was there's no young people following this tradition, and they were afraid of a demise of the thing in the near future. And I was always quick to bring up at our local regional gathering at Medora, North Dakota, we get 35 to 65-year-old rookies, I will say, every year. Their first time on stage, their first time with their poems or songs. And my take is on this, that when you're in your prime of life and youth and stuff, when you're cutting a wide swath, you're making history. You could care less about recording it. And as you get middle-aged and on, then it comes more important to you to preserve that history, so you start writing it down. We're an oral tradition to begin with. So, yeah, my take is on it, as you get older, you will become a singer and a poet and want to record it. So they were pretty pleased with that. It put their mind at ease a little on that.
I noticed one of the events happening, and again, the 35th Annual Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering is happening Memorial Day weekend in Medora. We are visiting with founder and organizer of the event, Bill Lohman. One of the events on Sunday morning is the Cowboy Gospel Singing Round Robin. What's it like to be in the room when this happens?
That's really gotten popular, and it's this walk-in. We pass a hat for a donation, but we didn't know what to do with that. Each day, Saturday and Sunday, we start at 1 o'clock, and we didn't know what to do with Sunday morning. And half of them had partied through the night and were hungover, and another half wanted to go to church. So we started a cowboy gospel singing, and it's not church, it's not preaching, it's this beautiful cowboy gospel song. And it's a round robin. Anybody that wants to participate will be called up by the MC and do a couple. And if there's time, they can come back and do a few more if everybody else is through. And it's really packed them in. It's really a popular event.
Yeah. How far away are some of these performers coming from?
We traditionally get about seven states and Canada, which, again, we've discussed, they got shut off again this year.
Yeah.
But we get about seven states, anywhere from Iowa to Iowa, Nebraska, Colorado, Washington. Oregon is coming in again this year. We get 7 to 10 states a year.
Hmm. You mentioned, Bill, that you are dyslexic. How long did you have dyslexia before it was noticed?
I'm in my 70s right now and ranched all my life, and I was in my 40s before they gave me credit of having dyslexia. I hated school. I struggled with school. I had to memorize everything to get through school. I stayed in school in high school because I loved my sports. I was good in athletics, and that's what kept me in school. Back then, they come up with a No Child Left Behind program since then, and I was slow child left behind back then. You were just slow.
But I would imagine, is it fair to say that work in memorization really helped the form of art that you do?
Exactly. That's exactly right. I can get up and recite off the top of my head from memory because of that, because I had to develop a good memory to get by in life.
Do you want to do one right now?
If you would want.
Yeah.
Want me to, I sure would.
How about a nice short one of your favorites?
Well, I've got one I wrote. This kind of goes back to what we're talking about. I'm the youngest of four. I have an older sister and two older brothers, and we grew up rough and reckless in the Badlands of western North Dakota, up out of Medora and Sentinel Butte, and we didn't have a telephone until I was in my mid-20s. We didn't have electricity till then. We mined our own coal in the creek below the barn, and this one I wrote kind of is a summation of that. It's called My Brothers and I. We grew up in the 50s and 60s, strong, rough, reckless, and sleek. We'd pick a fight with a blue northern most any day of the week. We made a habit of teasing the vultures and cheating the undertaker out of his pay. We busted our tails all day in the sun, but when night fell, we'd go out to play. We judged a girl by the distance between her hind pockets. Miller, Ole, and Bud were our friends. Dad gave us no slack the next mornings. Day's work started when daylight begins. But when the weekends come, we'd be at it again, out on the rodeo trail. In the rough stocks events, we competed, and with luck, have a check in the mail. We hand dug and hand set railroad ties by the hundreds, score after score, and pitched hay all day in the grueling hot sun, till every muscle we owned was sore. We dug water lines in with our shovels that measured in miles, not feet, and mined lignite from Wanigan's creek banks for a winter supply of heat. We drew short straw to shut down the Jacobs behind the house on the point of a bluff at midnight with lightning snapping our britches, never once thinking our lives were rough. We started colts and took in rank horses that others had tried and give up. We never allowed ourselves to be beaten and lived as carefree as our border collie pup. We wrestled and healed calves at the Brannings, chopped ice and fed cows at 40 below. Now at 70, I can't figure out why my joints hurt. I'm stooped over and slow while others are still young at 80, yet limber and handing out smiles. I've come to this deep thought conclusion. It ain't the years, but all the hard miles, my brothers and I. That's a pretty good summation.
Yeah, Bill, that was so beautiful. Thank you for sharing that.
But that's recording history from our past, and I didn't write that till I was older, because back then when we were doing it, we could care less about getting it done.
You had to get a lot of stuff done. Bill Lohman is the founder and organizer of the Dakota Cowboy Poetry Gathering. It is coming up this weekend in Medora. Bill, thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Did you ever imagine a kid from a small village in China could use the only thing he brought, his knowledge of cooking, to create what you've created?
I think this is only probably can happen in America.
That's renowned chef and host of the PBS cooking show Yan Can Cook, Martin Yan. Hear his story on Tuesday night's Prairie Public Presents As I Am, Asians in America.
I used my pinky finger to mark Minnesota. My father just stared down at the map and said, "That's just how it is. It really is far."
You'll also hear the story of one woman's journey to the Midwest and her longings for home. The mostly unknown story of Vietnamese-American communities in New Orleans during Katrina and of Chinese-Americans being priced out of affordable housing in a major city.
You have a section which is restaurants, but nobody really lives there.
Listen to As I Am, Asians in America, tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public Presents. Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 25th. Today we continue our series on National Preservation Month with a story on the Walla Theater in Walhalla, North Dakota. It was built in the modern style in 1949. It replaced a two-story opera house that had served the community for a number of decades, but following World War II, an update was needed to meet the needs and standards of the community. The new theater was designed by Minneapolis architects Perry E. Crozier and Sons and constructed immediately adjacent to the old opera house. That building later became a bowling alley and was eventually demolished. In 1949, good weather extending into the fall allowed builders to make good headway. It was slated to be completed in March of 1950, but a fire broke out in the new building. Luckily, it was contained, but this still caused a delay, with the grand opening finally taking place on June 22nd. Two new movies were scheduled for the opening, The Reformer and The Redhead. The Reformer and the Redhead, starring June Allison and Dick Powell, and The Daughter of Rosie O'Grady, starring June Haver and Gordon McRae. Aside from movies, the Walla Theater was a venue for distinctive annual events. This included the Santa Show, a community holiday celebration, and John Deere Day. Tex Ritter, America's most beloved cowboy, also appeared at the Walla in September of 1951. The building had some ornamentation around the front entrance with a lighted marquee. The facade was a pale pink beige with a bottom row of turquoise. Inside, there were seats for more than 400 people and a cry room, which allowed people with an unhappy child to still see and hear the film. The Walla closed in 1982. In 2008, the Gorge Arts and Heritage Council took up the cause of getting the theater back on its feet, restoring and repairing the building. It was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 2010 and reopened in 2018 with a grand opening in May of 2019 that featured Lori Lyne in a concert that sold out 2 weeks before the event. Tune in Thursday for our final date book about National Preservation Month, when we'll hear about a home in Bismarck in the style of Frank Lloyd Wright. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Sarah Walker. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Nursing homes in the U.S. are licensed by state, but in California, owners can keep running those homes even if their license is denied.
California has, in a sense, rolled out the red carpet for bad providers. Hey, it doesn't matter if you're a bad provider in California. You can get in the building, you can be a squatter, and they can't get you out.
A legal loophole that's putting residents at risk. On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, more small town celebrations as we spread into summer. And we're going to learn about the Jamestown Arts Center Downtown Arts Market. There will be live music, artisans, vendors, and a professional chalk artist. We're going to visit with Sean McCann, and we also talk with the executive director of the Arts Center, Mindy Schmitz. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.